Welcome to the podcast. I'm back with my executive producer, Jimmy Kennedy, to break down the week's events. And what a week it has been, Jimmy. What a week. It feels like a month was packed into this last week.
A lot going on, Noel. Some justice was served this week. More accountability has to be handed down. But yeah, another tumultuous week in American history. And we're going to dive all into it. So what's the top of your mind when it comes to rants this week, my man?
Well, I did that car rant yesterday on this Chauvin trial. And it's interesting that the reaction from the right immediately was, well, they had to find him guilty. Otherwise, there would have been rioting, you know, or there's even more conspiratorial stuff, like Lauren Boebert said, I've been hearing that, you know, people contacted the jurors and everything, you know, mm-hmm. because they couldn't accept the verdict. The verdict was this guy killed an innocent man. You know, he was innocent in the fact he did not deserve to die there on the street. Nobody does. You know, that's why we have a system of laws in this country and why we have a court system. You're judged guilty by a jury of your peers, not a sociopathic police officer who had been doing that for 19 years that he was on the force. There's another case now coming against him where he did the same thing to a teenage boy, kept his knee on his neck. So, you know, we got into a lot of that last week and on the special episode we did with my friend Nick, who was NYPD. To him, it appeared personal, and that's what I thought too. You know, they worked together in a nightclub, and I was feeling like when Chauvin got him there on the street, he was like, this is my time now. You know, I'm the boss now. We're not co-equal employees in a nightclub. Like, I'm the man and I own these streets, because it was clearly sadistic. And we all saw that, and we can close the chapter on that. But in many ways, you know, it's too little too late. Imagine if you're an African-American person, Rodney King happened when I was younger than you. I was 20, 21 years old. I lived in DC and worked on Capitol Hill. And, you know, the all-white jury in Simi Valley found those cops not guilty for the same crime, for beating a man horrifically on the street, you know, for a mm-hmm. traffic stop. And they got off for it, because back then it wasn't even a question. You know, it was like cops basically can't be found guilty. And the cops were terrorizing people in LA forever. And like, hip hop tried to warn us, you know, NWA and those guys, Ice-T, were like, yo, these guys are psychos, you know. And later it came out in the Rampart scandal and everything that they were operating like a gang. And apparently they still are. And that's what happens in policing. And what also happens is that a lot of society, predominantly white society, is sort of willing to look the other way, because crime is scary, and crime that happens, you know, in minority neighborhoods, it's played up in the media to be extra scary. In the 80s and 90s, we were told there were super predators. You know, in New York City, they would talk about wolf packs, you know, these teenagers that would be going on the subway and they would just mercilessly kill you. And, you know, Donald Trump tried to hang a bunch of teens who were later found, you know, innocent of attacking a woman in my neighborhood, you know, in Central Park. That's the crossover is where it happened. I go by there every day of my life. And I pray still for that victim. Every time I'm reminded of it. But it was a double tragedy back then, because an opportunist used it to sort of proselytize hate, you know, and perpetuate his agenda of white supremacy and this law and order thing that's sort of like, I'm what law looks like. A wealthy white man with silver hair is law. You know, and the guy in a blue uniform who's standing in front of me is the arbiter of justice in all cases. And right. That's simply not true. And that's what this case showed us. And that's what they reacted to, because, you know, I'll let you speak here. But like, that's why they only could have one reaction, you know, because finding Chauvin guilty was bad for their brand. And they already know that the Fox viewers won't accept it, because if they accept it, then they have to question everything else that Fox is peddling to them, you know, which is like blue lives matter. Of course, all lives matter. You know, it's not blue lives and black lives. It's just, it's insane. You go for a second. I'm too mad just even thinking about it.
Well, I think the thing that gets me, and, you know, growing up in a predominantly white suburb of Indianapolis, I wasn't exposed to it. I didn't have the experience of it. But it's becoming clear, and it's known within the communities of people of color, that this has been going on for a long time. It's just being documented now. That's the difference. And that's kind of the blessing of the 24-hour news cycle, is that you might catch a Facebook Live feed of... a policeman honestly carrying out a crime in real time. You know, imagine if that Facebook Live video wasn't captured, how different that would have made that trial. And in talking about what you had talked about, the kind of the unity that police forces have for one another, it's sort of a fraternity with the backing of the government. And, you know, it allows for the imprisonment of certain minorities within society, and they're running scared. You know, society's changing slowly. I mean, I can feel it. I don't know about you, but there's a sense of panic among those that are white and have had the advantage.
Absolutely, because that is how they come to power politically. Rudy Giuliani began his political career in New York City. This was after he was an attorney general, you know, or SDNY prosecutor. He joined these cops that were having a protest down at City Hall in New York City, right? And the cops were mad about like these policing issues, and they started having these verbal tirades against the black members of New York City Council. And they were berating them. They were using racial slurs to talk about these black councilwomen and stuff as they were walking into City Hall. And Rudy Giuliani hopped on top of a car, grabbed a bullhorn, and started egging on these cops. Right? That's when his mayoral career began, that day, because he realized there was power in joining the sort of resentment that exists in the police force and exploiting it for political capital in the white community. And that's what he went on to do as mayor. They were always like, well, Rudy cleaned up New York. Well, you know how he did that? Stop and frisk. You know, he brought in Ray Kelly, and anybody black getting on a subway or walking down the street in Harlem would get thrown up against a wall. You know, they would search their bags. They would search their pockets. Everybody has weed. Like, it's legal now everywhere, right? But, you know, they find a dime bag on you and it's three strikes and you're out, or some cocaine, the same stuff they're selling down the street in Trump Tower, right? But they lock these kids up, and people liked it. You know, people weren't mad about it, because then when they went in to see their play on Sunday afternoon in New York City, when they drove in from Long Island, all of a sudden the city looked a little different. You know, there weren't as many squeegee guys, and maybe their car wasn't going to get broken into. And it's not to say there wasn't crime, but this thing that was given a peaceful kind of title, it was called broken windows policing. You know, it was Bill Bratton and Ray Kelly and these guys, and they were kind of like, well, that's how you do it. You get the guys that are jumping the turnstile, and then you stop the murders and the shootings and stuff. And in reality, that didn't happen. You know, they just locked up a bunch of innocent people, took people out of their communities, further disenfranchising communities, further, you know, burdening the people that have to live there. But like you said, making a lot of money for the prison industrial complex, and also making police look like they're heroes. You know, so people didn't want to look at that stuff. Some people did. Springsteen looked at it. You know, he wrote a song called 41 Shots about how they killed Amadou Diallo, who was an African-American man in Harlem. And at the height of this Giuliani policing, these guys sort of like saw a black guy walking down the street, going up to his doorstep, and they were like, freeze. And he went to reach for his wallet, and they just lit him up. You know, they just shot him. They all opened fire. And it was a squad of these cops that were in plain clothes, and their job was to like drive around, you know, Harlem and the South Bronx as if it was a war zone, and sort of harass anybody that they deemed to be a suspect. And that's what Nick talked about last week. You know, he was kind of in that, he was in that era. And he told me things about that era, that their marching orders were to go out and mess up black people. Like, that was the gig, you know, go to their hood, bring the fight to them essentially, so they don't come down and like, you know, get in Midtown and the Upper East Side, right? So they killed this guy. Springsteen wrote a beautiful song about it from both points of view, right? From the point of the view of the officer who's driving in from Jersey and has got a young wife at home and he's scared, you know, doing this job. And from, you know, the point of view of the victim, you know. And I met his parents, so they came to a Springsteen show. And so when Bruce debuted this show, this was in 2000, at Madison Square Garden, he played the song in Atlanta the night before, and then he was going to begin this 10 show run in New York City that I was a part of. I was like a local runner, right? So the headline was that the head of the police union heard about that Springsteen was like, you know, had written this song about this major incident that happened in New York City. And the head of the police union basically put a fatwa on Springsteen. You know, he was boycott him. How dare he? And we had cops showing up at the show, getting drunk, like running up to the stage, flipping off Bruce. We had to have a lockdown backstage. And that feud went on for years with the cops in New York City. Because it was basically like, and I'm saying this to your point, it was like, how dare you criticize us? You know, when a cop gets killed, it's tragic, but like 10,000 cops come out and have a funeral procession for the guy, you know, as they should, they honor it. But it's like the world stops when a cop gets killed. When somebody that is, when the cops kill somebody, they don't want you to look at it. And they certainly don't want you to memorialize it in song and ask deeper questions. They want you to sort of honor this cops with no questioning. And that gets enforced by the police unions. You know, the head of the police union right now in New York City is a huge Trumper, you know, and he's an awful guy. He's just an awful punk guy who's not doing his people in blue any favors. But like you said, they operate as a gang, you know, and they were like a gang. Like you talk, when Nick came to see me, I lived in D.C. when he was like on his first few years on the job. This was the early 90s. And in Memorial Day every year, they had a big police memorial where all the cops would come down to this national memorial they have for officers that get killed in the line of duty, which is a tragic thing, you know, and there's a lot of great cops. I'm not saying they're all bad or whatever, but these guys came down and they were wilding. Like it was the most insane. It was like partying with Vikings. Bro, it was scary. And I used to drink back then. Like I was a drunk and like a party crazy animal, young 20s, you know, and I was like, wow, these guys are nuts. And they later got in trouble for this. It became a scandal. 15 years later, people found out about it because they were assaulting women in their hotels and stuff. It was like, imagine the drunkest frat house you've ever seen, but they have badges and guns, you know, and chips on their shoulder. A lot of the cops I know, it's all about money. They're pissed that they don't make any money, or they don't make enough money. And if you ever want to piss off a cop, you know, like if he pulls you over, be like, I pay your salary or something, you know, like they're really mad that they don't get a fair shake and economically and teachers don't and whatever. So cops have like, a lot of them just have a big chip on their shoulder, you know, and it's too, they're made to think, they're made to act like they're an invading army when they go into this neighborhood and these neighborhoods. And Nick made a great point last week. He said, like, bring back community policing. You know, right. If I grow up in that neighborhood, like, you're going to know me. You're going to know my dad and my mom and my family. It's not going to be this instant confrontation when I pull you over. You're going to be like, hey, that's Nicky. He went to, you know, Fresh Kills High School with me or whatever, you know, but as it is now, it's like a lot of the cops in New York, they all come out of Staten Island, they go into the rest of the city, and it's an us versus them kind of thing. And that just doesn't work.
Well, and politically, the ambition was too racially motivated. You know, one of the reasons Stop and Frisk was primarily against people of color was it kind of creates a us versus them mentality, similar to when Donald Trump launched his campaign. You know, Mexicans, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, but I'm sure some are good people. You know, like that immediately divided the audience when it came to Trump. And that's what Giuliani and Trump have always been about, is dividing people. They're not about unity. They're not about solidarity among groups of people, because they lose power when that happens.
Absolutely. You know? Because they need to remain the protected class, you know, they're inferior otherwise, you know. Giuliani didn't like, he wasn't, people say America's mayor, the guy was an egomaniac narcissist. I could do a whole show on that. I've worked with the guy on shows. He's horrible. I tell people this, like, you think Donald Trump is bad, you meet Rudy Giuliani. The guy is like, he's been a partner with Trump in everything, you know, and going after the mob, you know, and letting the Russians come into like what used to be the Italian mob. Like Rudy is as corrupt a man as New York City has ever produced. And he rose to power on that same law and order thing. And Trump saw that, you know, it wasn't like Rudy wasn't one of Trump's main advisors. Rudy tried to be president too, and he got prostate cancer and he had to drop out. That was years, you know, before. But so, yeah. Well,
and one quick thing. Was part of the hatred for Hillary Clinton with Donald Trump being that she was a senator from New York?
Well, she was running against Giuliani. That's when he first had to drop out. He was running against her for the you know, for the Senate seat. That was that, not.
That's what I thought. Yeah, because right, like that had to have caused a rift between those two. You know.
Well, because, yeah, Rudy wanted that seat and Alphonse D'Amato was like Rudy's boy. And I can't remember exactly if it was Alphonse's seat that became vacant, but it was around that time. So Alphonse was a kind of a guy who was like Rudy Giuliani, like Italian-American, like law and order dude, but kind of corrupt, and would pose with Rudy Giuliani. They would be like, we raided a crack house in Hell's Kitchen today, which is like, there weren't crack houses in Hell's Kitchen. And they'd be posing in front of the thing. There's a famous picture, and I put it on Twitter once, and like Alphonse is wearing like a Hell's Angels, like leather, like vest and stuff, because they tried to pretend like they went in there undercover and busted, you know, the bad guy selling crack. And it was just a photo op, you know. Rudy's whole life was photo ops. 9/11, he turned into a photo op. That's why the command center was down at the World Trade Center and why it was destroyed. All the chiefs told him, put it out in Brooklyn. They're going to attack the World Trade Center. Give us a place where we're going to be able to communicate with our people. You know, it'll get destroyed if you put it down there. But Rudy wanted to be able to walk from City Hall down there when something happened, so the press could like show him showing up on the scene, you know. And I lived across the street from him when all that went down, from Gracie Mansion. And when he told everybody the air was safe to breathe, he was coming home every night with a mask on his face for months until December. And everyone knew the air wasn't safe to breathe. I mean, it was horrific. It was this acrid, horrible smoke. And Nick worked on that pile. That's why he retired. He got some rare disease from being down there. That's why he lives out in the dry desert now in California, because he can't breathe in New York anymore because his lungs are so damaged from breathing that smoke. Giuliani didn't care about that. You know, he capitalized on 9/11 every opportunity he could. He made millions traveling the world afterwards talking about security, and the guy made it worse, including the radios, you know. So, but Trump knew that, you know. They hated, Trump didn't hate Hillary too. To answer your question, Hillary and Bill were at Trump's wedding to Melania. They were at the wedding. Trump was a Democrat when I worked for him. He switched again in 2008 because of Barack Obama got elected, and he hated that because he was raised by a racist father. He was a guy who openly used the N-word all the time on The Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice. He called the contestants N-words, like to the producers, in earshot of them. Like he's one of the most racist people you'll ever meet, as are his children. So it just, it offended everything that his warped little mind stood for, that this brilliant African-American man, you know, who came from nothing in comparison to Donald Trump,
right,
you know, like, and earned it all on his own, a law degree from Columbia, you know, made the Harvard Law Review, or he went to Columbia undergrad, Harvard Law Review, you know.
Trump had a faux Obama. Remember, he hired a fake Obama, right, that he could yell at.
Yeah, to come into his office. There's video of that. Yeah, no, it was like, yeah, his worldview can't include minorities. And like I said at the top of this rant, it's because they have to be the protected class. You know, the hidden secret is like, these people don't want to work that hard and they're not that smart. But just by being the fact that they're white, you know, and they're born in a certain area, they're expected to have a certain level of comfort in life. And if it becomes equal, it's not going to be that comfortable for them. And that's what they're finding now. You know, that's what Trump exploited, was people in the suburbs were like, God damn, I can't just go to a factory and make $30 an hour anymore, you know, and get a house and do all this stuff. Like, the world's changed, and they didn't want to keep up. And instead of training people and re-educating them, which is what Barack Obama proposed and tried to do for people, was like, look, you're going to need health care. I'm going to give you universal health care, and you're going to have to retrain because that factory ain't coming back. Right. But Trump lied to him, like, oh, it's coming back. I'm bringing back big, beautiful steel and beautiful, delicious, clean coal is going to come back to West Virginia. None of these jobs have come back to these places. It was a scam. You know, it's outmoded. It'd be like, yo, dinosaurs are the shit. I am telling you guys, I'm going to bring dinosaurs back. You know, we're going to use whale oil. You know, it's just like, it's the dumbest thing ever, clean coal. You know, it's like, but people bought it because it's easier to pay attention to a huckster who's waving the flag and saying the same kind of crap that you say around the kitchen table, that you know, your life sucks because a Mexican's coming to take your job, you know, than it is to be like, wow, I'm going to have to figure out how to adjust to this new economy. or even better, I'm going to figure out why it's so messed up. And the irony of this whole thing is it's messed up because of the Republicans, because you voted for Reagan or your dad did, and he moved all those factories overseas and told corporations they didn't have to pay taxes anymore. So guess what? You know, a few people who sat on the board of directors got really rich, and the people who traded those stocks got really rich, but the dudes who worked in those factories got kicked out. You know, and a couple of generations of that, and the town is rusted, and it's a rust belt, and they're ripe for fascism. That's how fascism rises all over the world. That's how it happened in Germany. You know, that's how terrorism happens in the Middle East. They don't go to like rich guys that are getting educated and say, hey, you want to strap on a bomb? You know, mm-hmm. They go into neighborhoods where young men are like angry. You know, they're angry, and they see their families facing indignities. You know, that's how, and then they align it with an ethnocentric or a religious component. And that's what Trump did. It's Christianity. It's you're the chosen people. You're the big, beautiful Christians. You have gods and guns, and you need to take what's yours back. You know, meanwhile, he's not even paying these cities, right? Albuquerque just sent a bill to collections this week that he still owes them. You know, that was for two campaigns ago. He stiffed cities for two campaign cycles, and he's still raising money.
Yeah, the crazy thing, you know, for the folks that complain about the Affordable Care Act, that was a pro-business deal. You know, there isn't a public option yet for healthcare to be covered. You know, not everybody's on Medicare at this point. That's why people are pushing Medicare for All so hard, so that we can have basic, you know, preventative medicine be affordable for a majority of people. And what we've been talking about throughout this podcast, it all comes back to income inequality. If you allow folks to earn a decent wage where they can build wealth, have access to healthy food, recreation, all the sort of things that people need in order to be successful, ultimately you're going to have a successful society across the board. But they know in order to keep the advantage, you got to keep suppressing everybody around you that's a threat to that lifestyle.
That's a very good point, Jimmy. A very good point, because what you're talking about is a holistic approach. You know, health happens because you eat properly, you exercise properly, you have proper health care and medical care from an early age, you have preschool, you know, you have a community that's going to support you and help you thrive. And that flies in the face of Republicanism, because it's all about big coal plants and big trucks and big cars in the name of commerce. You know, that the lie that they sell these people is that the wealth will solve all the problems. And it doesn't. You know, money only gets you so far. There should be a basic, you know, amount of income that everybody has, and a basic human right to health care, to affordable housing, to education, right? And then you can sort of be who you're meant to be. But it's not, the trickle down thing doesn't work. And they just always come back to the free market, and they're able to manipulate these people who have so little, because, you know, your taxes mean so much. And they're always like, they're going to raise your taxes. And Trump raised taxes on my neighborhood. You know, he raised taxes, and he punished the people that didn't vote for him with a mortgage income tax. You know, so he used to be able to write off like 15,000 and above, and he put a cap on that. I think it was 10 grand or something. So like, he screwed everybody in Long Island and Westchester and out on the West Coast who didn't vote for him. You know, so he raised taxes on people, and he also paid for his huge, massive like tax cut for corporations and the wealthy by running up the deficit. You know, by literally increasing it like trillions of dollars, the most irresponsible stuff that your kids are going to be paying for, Jimmy. We're not even talking about it yet, because we're in such a hole we can't deal with it. Trump did that. And Obama had it under control. Clinton had it a surplus. Bill Clinton was so good at that stuff that when he left office, we had a surplus. And within a year of George W. Bush, we were back into trillions of dollars of a deficit to fight a war that had nothing to do with 9/11, but put a lot of money in the pockets of Halliburton, who happened to be his vice president's ex-company. You know, it's all a scam. They steal the money. What they tell people is like, I'm going to give you back your money. But what reality is, I'm going to take that money for me and my wealthy friends. And we're going to manipulate you by saying, hey, look over here. Meanwhile, we're stuffing it in our pockets. I mean, what did your hometown hero, Mike Pence, do? What did you hear recently about Mike Pence and his vacation?
Oh, yeah. He just passed it off, passed the buck to the American citizen. And I have an uncle who's in the Secret Service, you know, so I don't know what the job is, but I understand that, you know, he's got a pretty high rate with the training that he had to go through in order to protect people of that magnitude. So, and when you're Mike Pence, you're going to have an entourage. You know, I talked about when he came to Lucas Oil Stadium and ended up leaving after the anthem and the kneeling controversy during that time. It takes a group of people and a lot of money, a lot of extra security for a single person to attend an event like that.
You don't have to tell me, brother. Yeah. I did a gazillion events with presidents and Secret Service. You know, 9/11, we had four or five living presidents when we opened the memorial. I did two inaugurations with Barack Obama. I was Clinton's handler whenever he'd go somewhere as an ex-president, but there's still a footprint. You get it for life. And yeah. Mike Pence spent like, it was $775,000 or something ridiculous like that. It was almost $1 million for a Vail ski vacation for the Secret Service alone. That's not all the hotel rooms for the support staff. That's just the security detail, you know?
Well, he flew across Ireland just so that he could stay at a Trump resort.
Right.
He went there for a visit, you know, like.
Dunebeck. Yeah.
Mike and Donnie are cut from the same cloth. He's just a little more smooth about it. That's all.
Absolutely. You know, and Mike Pompeo is the same way. They're all grifters. That's who Trump hires. He's only going to hire compromised people. Somebody with ethics is going to be out of there in 10 seconds. You know, they're going to say Walter Schaub left. You know, people are like, you know, who was the watchdog? You know, he was one of the government watchdogs. He was like, I'm not going to be here. Like, and he speaks out against it. But Trump gets people like your Scott Pruitts, you know, he gets these guys that he knows are eminently corruptible and venal, and then he exploits them. And the real smart ones kind of get over on him. You know, Wilbur Ross got over on Trump. Like, he didn't do anything, enriched himself, and now he's scamming and still making more money. And nobody looked at Wilbur Ross. You know, it was just like, is that guy he would fall asleep in cabinet meetings, you know, but he was a craftier guy, you know. But then the dumb ones are so blatant about it. Your Ben Carsons and stuff, you know, they get busted getting these tea sets and all this stuff, but they all knew they could do it. And that's what Trump offers. That's, you know, Amy Coney Barrett has a $2 million book deal to talk about being a justice, right? She's been a justice, right, for what, 6 months, not even, you know, 6 months now she's been on the Supreme Court. She'd only been a judge for 3 years before that. Like, what does she know about being a judge? Nothing. But if you take this assignment when Trump approached her, you're going to profit from it. You're going to make money. So she was corruptible, you know. Kavanaugh, the guy's a psychopath. He voted this week to like be allowed to sentence children to life in prison. And the case that they heard was a kid who had mental issues, who had been abused by like an alcoholic father who was in a step family, and he was getting abused by a grandfather, and he killed the guy in self-defense. He stabbed him, right? And basically Brett Kavanaugh wrote a decision that said, there's no second chances. Like, he's allowed to be sentenced to jail in life as a child.
Bro, right? You were given a second chance and a lifetime appointment. Are you serious?
Not to mention you were a rapist as a teenager. You know, that guy was clearly a rapist. You're never going to tell me that guy wasn't a rapist. And I saw the way his wife and children looked. They looked abused. I know that look, you know, and every woman who's been there knows that look. I'm not a woman, but I've been around a lot of abuse and a lot of like those kind of men. And I know what it looks like. And so that guy's a scumbag. Brett Kavanaugh is a scumbag's scumbag. Right. And we don't even have to get into Deutsche Bank and all the debt that was paid off, his $200,000 country club fees and all this stuff. But my point is, he was corruptible. You know, let's find a guy who will do our bidding, who's an asshole, right, who already believes in this conservative stuff that the white male is the dominant force in the universe and all laws must serve him. Right. Let's already get somebody who believes that crap. And then let's find out if they like to cheat on their wife or if they drink too much or if they like to fuck young girls. Sorry for cursing. This isn't a show that you're but whatever. You get my point, you know. Yeah. So that's what Trump attracts. He attracts scumbags. He attracts Roger Stone, who just threatened somebody on Twitter this afternoon. you know, somebody who called Patriot Takes, who like does screenshots of the crazy stuff they're saying on Parler. And, and Roger Stone was like, send this guy to see St. Peter, like find out who this guy is, basically like threatened his life. He also threatened a judge's life. You know, he showed a picture of a judge with her face in crosshairs when he was on trial. Right. That's insane. And we started this show talking about locking up young black men for nothing, you know, stop and frisk, searching them. And if they had any a joint in their pocket, they went to prison.
Well, going back to Brett Kavanaugh, I have to make one more point. If I went into any job interview, I don't care who it's with. If I said I like beer, I'm not getting that job. Even if I went to Budweiser and I said I like beer, they're not hiring me. You know, you know, only a guy that's compromised and it's already worked out is going to get a lifetime employment after saying something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And he didn't just say, I like beer. He screamed it with spit flying out of his mouth.
I like beer. Now,
right. He was, because he was so incensed that they would even question him. He was told this was a slam dunk. And it was a slam dunk. We later learned the FBI didn't really do an investigation on that weekend. They said they were going to do an investigation. They didn't really call anybody or turn over any rocks. It was all a show. And the Jeff guy, Jeff Flake, flew up to New York. You know, I was doing the Global Citizens Festival that weekend in New York City. So he and the other senator who were sort of like, hey, let's hold up here and have an investigation, gave the left hope. You know, we were sort of thinking like, hey, maybe they're going to do the right thing and really look into who this guy is. Because on his high school yearbook alone, it was obvious he was a messed up dude. You know, it was like that dude did some bad things. And so you had hope for a weekend. And Jeff Flake came up and he was hanging out in the green room with us at this Global Citizens Fest, you know, and, you know, shaking hands and sort of standing there taking it, you know, from the left and, you know, sort of being like, yeah, you know, I want the right thing to happen. It was a smoke and mirrors. He was just sent up there to sort of put on a show, buy him a couple days. And what happened? He voted to confirm him. They all did. You know, it's a white man's world. And the judiciary is how you make that law. You know, it's how you make that unreproachable. And that's why they're fighting so hard now. Like, don't pack the courts. You saw, you know, Fat Wolverine is what I already called him. You know, what's his name, used it this week and got a lot of accolades. But I'd been calling him that for years, you know, Ted Cruz. And he gave a speech, you know, he gave a video, like whatever you call these things. That's basically all they exist for now, these senators and congressmen, just these video clips. It's like me doing a car rant. Like, you're a congressman or a senator, go inside and legislate, you know, but he's out there doing this thing like, we wouldn't pack the courts. We wouldn't do any of that. Yeah, you did. Merrick Garland never got a vote. You know, we had an empty seat for a year and a half, thanks to Mitch McConnell. Right. But they're terrified if we did expand the court, which we should, it should at least match the amount of like appellate courts and things like that. You know, we have all these other federal circuit judges and then just like 9 Supreme Court justices. This is insane.
Well, and let's take it even further. The court should resemble what it is meant to do. As of right now, it leans right. And that's being nice about it. You know, packing the court with judges that are a little more liberal would make the court more centrist. And that's fair. You know, you want to govern from the middle, especially when it comes to the law, where you have a balance to that sort of thing, right? The symbol for law has always been back and forth, the scale. So just from its original intention, we should add to the court.
Absolutely. You know, I was talking with Glenn Kirshner and Andrew Laufer on a show this week, and I made the same point. You know, the scales of justice need to be balanced. And that's why they reacted so vociferously to what they saw Tuesday, they being Fox News and the right. You know, that's why Ted Cruz had a press conference the next day or the day after saying you can't pack the courts. Like, what? This can't happen. We can't hold people accountable. We have to be in charge. And you're being polite talking about the Supreme Court, you know, skewing to the right. Clarence Thomas is out of his freaking mind. And he doesn't show up half the time. And his wife, Ginny Thomas, was one of the main purveyors of the Capitol attack on January 6th. Right. Like, she's a psycho, QAnon, crazy Trumpist. And her husband is a justice. You know, it's horrific. I don't even want to get it on a tangent, but like Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. I was doing a live show on a Friday night. And she died. And by the time I ended the show, Mitch McConnell and Trump had announced that like Amy Coney Barrett was going to be the replacement and they were going to vote to confirm her. And we were like weeks away from the election, you know, and they rushed her through and she did a campaign commercial. She got sworn in and they did a campaign commercial the same night in the White House, which it should never happen. Like a justice shouldn't be allied with any particular executive, you know, president.
And one thing that Amy Coney Barrett did that was just, it made me want to vomit, seriously, when I saw it. It was when she held up that notepad and there was nothing written on it.
Yeah.
You know, that's just rude.
Yeah.
That's just rude. That's smug. You know, like she's from Notre Dame. You know, I'm from Indiana. I've always been a Notre Dame fan because I'm Irish. But like, and you know, she has her credentials, but that was just smug and wrong to do on a national stage like that, in my opinion.
You know? Yeah, well, she's smug. I mean, she showed up for a super spreader event on the White House lawn. She showed up with her kids without wearing a mask, knowing she had just had the virus weeks before. She could have been spreading it to people. She doesn't care. You know, that's the problem, is like people don't care. Back to your earlier point, they sort of like a holistic approach to society. Like one of the themes I talk about is how Reagan cut funding to the arts and the Republicans have never replenished those. They don't want you paying attention to the arts. You know, they want you paying attention to NASCAR and football and stuff. Not that those things are bad. Jimmy worked for the Colts, right?
Love football. Love exactly. Football.
I worked on the Super Bowl. I'm no expert in football, but I like it. But that's not culture. You know, that's athletics.
Well, and one more point, you know, the other issue is they're not letting these players who have, you know, Twitter followings and different things. LeBron James got in trouble for, you know, being critical this week of policing throughout the country when Donald Trump, every waking moment of the day, was sending tweets that were dividing folks. You know,
I know. Thanks for giving a shout out to my best friend, LeBron James. I appreciate it. Love me, yeah. LeBron, man. And I saw on Twitter today, like LeBron trolled him and retweeted it. But some bar owner was like, I'm no longer going to be showing like LeBron's games in Ohio in my bar. You know, it's like, hey, good luck with that, buddy. You know,
the entire economy collapses without LeBron in Ohio. Believe me.
I was out there for a final. I know people who work for the Cavs. I was out there when he was playing in the Cavs with some finals and, it was amazing. You know, those were my favorite. That's my favorite LeBron era, you know, more than the Lakers stuff. Like, and I remember being out there and I went to have lunch and I read by myself and I read in a local paper about his program in Akron, you know, about like his charity and stuff. And I ended up crying when I finished the article. Like tears came to my eyes, because talk about a holistic approach. Like he did this thing where he was trying to motivate kids to do well in school and they'd get a bike if they got good grades and they'd get to go to like this summer camp and stuff. And then he invited their moms with him, you know? So it wasn't just like, I'm going to give the kid a scholarship or get the kid ahead. He was helping the parents too. He was helping the community because he knew that that would be a lasting benefit, that involving the parents in these educations and in these rewards going away to summer camp was going to heal and strengthen those families. And it was so beautiful. It spoke to me about a guy who really understood humanity, you know, who really understood what these communities need and was willing to give it, and not in an egocentric way. Like I'd never heard of this. I only read it in this local paper in Akron. It wasn't like, and I worked for the NBA for 10, you know, for 10 All-Star games before this date or whatever, you know, it wasn't like I wasn't exposed to LeBron James and his press. It was just something he did on the DL. And it was just this one component of his charity that made me think like this guy's much bigger than a basketball player. And I hope that guy runs for office someday. I mean, LeBron is a class act and just a giant in many ways, besides just a giant on the basketball court. I mean, the guy's he's my favorite basketball player ever. And I've met Michael Jordan.
Yeah. I mean, Nick Wright probably had the best description of LeBron that I've ever heard. He said, I've seen a lot of people play basketball. There's nobody better at basketball than LeBron James. And I would agree. And just to touch on his background, you know, he has a high school education. Like the guy is extremely educated and experienced in his ability to reach the masses. He kind of transcends society. So yeah, I hope that eventually he does run for office, because I think he can make an impact wherever he decides to go.
Absolutely. And he carries himself like a king. You know, he doesn't, I would always pay attention to the players when I did the All-Star game, like how they would come in with their boys or their entourage. And there's not a lot of that in the NBA. The NBA is just a very kind of like buttoned up kind of class act with rules and stuff. You know, it's not like what you see in the NFL, which is like completely different, as you know what I mean? It's like not even the same things. Like I try to tell people that, and I feel like they don't even really understand, you know. But LeBron is like, he always comes in like he means business. You know, he would always have his hoodie on, you know, and he would come in like he was approaching the finals, you know. And it's the All-Star game. It doesn't matter. Nobody even watches it. You know, it's an exhibition kind of goofy thing so everybody can get together for a weekend and smoke pot. You know, like that's what the All-Star weekend is. It's a party, and it's a good party. If you've never been there, like, go. It's a wonderful thing for a lot of different communities. But, you know, he would show up like he was, like it was the Super Bowl. You know, I know it's the wrong sport, but that's the intensity that he seemed to carry himself with. And that's always impressive. The other guy, and Kobe Bryant was like that too. You know, Kobe Bryant was always behind the scenes, like seemed to know everybody in the hallways and stop and say hello. And the thing I noticed about Kobe is that other players would look at Kobe when he walked by, like the other players would be like, wow, there's Kobe. You know, like it was like everyone kind of got quiet when he came in. You know, he carried himself with some grace, too.
The thing that always impressed me about Kobe, he grew up in Italy because his father was an international player, and he spoke fluent Italian. Yeah. Like he would answer questions in Italian. Like the guy was just gone far too soon and tragically in that helicopter crash. But, you know, he was able to win an Academy Award before he passed. He's got a brand new infant daughter that Pau Gasol, that was one of his best buddies from the Lakers, is looking after. So there's plenty of people in that community that are going to look after Kobe's kids. And I hope that the NBA, you know, makes a new logo or does something to solidify Kobe's legacy. Because the people in my generation, he was our Michael Jordan, you know. Michael Jordan in comparison to Kobe, there's a lot of similarities there. So it's still kind of a hard thing to believe that Kobe's not here anymore.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. And I was your age when Kobe came into the league, which is just nuts. But, well, you know, so there you go. So like sports has all these other things, you know, I shouldn't have said it's not culture. It is, you know, and it has these offshoots, and these people are leaders in many ways, and they're leaders in their communities. And that again is a threat to the right. They don't want them speaking out. They don't want LeBron James speaking out. They don't want Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, you know, and they want to silence them if they do.
And you have a guy like, you know, Jim Jordan that continues to be in office because of gerrymandering, and he's failed to pass any kind of legislation in his 14th year on Congress. You know, who would be more impactful, Jim Jordan or LeBron James? I think I would take LeBron 10 out of 10 times.
God, please let that happen. Please, God, let that happen. And, you know, Jim Jordan isn't there to pass laws. He's there to be a troll. He's there to get annoying at committee hearings and berate the African-American women that are about to become deputy AGs. That's what he's there for. He's there to scream and pound on the desk, you know, and look all outraged with his crooked jaw and his cauliflower ears and his midget stance. Oh, that's a bad word. I shouldn't say midget. I'm short too, you know, but like, you know, have you ever seen the guy? He's 5'3" and he says he's 5'7". Like, who does that? I'm 5'7". You know, like if you're 5'3", you're 5'3". Own it. Like, I'm 5'7". I'm not going to say I'm 6 foot.
He's 5'3"?
That's what I heard. Well, wow. Well, no one really knows, because Matt Gaetz is technically 5'7". And when Matt Gaetz is next to Jim Jordan in a photograph, Matt Gaetz is a lot taller. Right? He's at least 4 or 5 inches taller. So what gives here? Either Matt Gaetz is wearing high heels like his, you know, like his surrogate father, Donald Trump, who had these 4-inch lifts in his shoes, and he lied about his height. Trump is 6 foot, would tell everybody he's 6'4", and he'd wear Cuban heels. You know, like, what is wrong with these guys? So yeah, Jim Jordan's either 5'3" or 5'7". And it's insane. You know, it's like, these guys just exist to be annoying. Lauren Boebert, like, the, you know, I've talked about her before. I don't think you could get a bigger idiot in Congress. Like, she tried to put out a video today saying, like, I'm passing a bill or introducing a bill for energy dominance. We're going to make, and there was like five speaking mistakes in her little like video clip. Like, it was like as many times as I mess up saying something on this podcast, you know, but I'm a podcaster who's ranting for an hour, you know. She's a congressman who can't really talk. And part of it's not her fault. I mean, her middle name is Opal and she was born in Florida. So she really didn't ever stand a chance. You know, forget about that she dropped out of high school and went to work at McDonald's. A lot of people have to do that. There's no shame in that. But you don't get your GED and then run for Congress because you're holding a rifle and then get to Congress and think you're going to like challenge, you know, the status quo and you're this new like warrior. You know, she was talking about Biden and like Biden is the enemy. They're just following these marching orders. And here's a new point that I hadn't thought of before. It's like the strain, you know, how like people develop strains of like weed or something and they get stronger and stronger. Like you breed something to be stronger. It seems like the GOP is breeding stupidity and they're trying to get these guys dumber and dumber, right? Because if you think about it, Jim Jordan is like, you know, Winston Churchill compared to like Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? You know what I mean? Like that, like that, she's like a rabid dog, you know, like she is just like, what is wrong with this person? And I promise you, that is not going to end well with her. Like, I guarantee you, like, she is going to be leaving Congress in handcuffs someday. Like, she is a loose cannon. If I was a principal of a school and she was a teacher, I would be proactive and like calling up the teachers union and be like, you have to remove this person. Like, she's going to stab a student or something because she does not look mentally well at all.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but to add to your point that like the GOP stupidity continues to get stronger, she makes Sarah Palin look smart. They're both fools. They're on the same scale, but yeah, it continues to get stronger. You know, this has been going back to the McCain campaign, bringing in Sarah Palin, trying to beat Barack Obama for his second term.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and Sarah Palin was at least pretty, you know, at least she was telegenic. You know, she looked like she would be this smart woman who could be a politician. Lauren Boebert looks like she's playing Sarah Palin in a high school production. You know, she looked like... True. Right? Give me, yeah. She looks like McLovin. Did you ever see Superbad?
Oh, yeah.
That's what she sounds like. She sounds like if you put a wig and some glasses on McLovin and we're like, you're going to play a congresswoman now, you know, like she looks like she's play acting because she is. If I went to Congress, I would be intimidated. I would be so scared that I didn't know enough and I don't know enough. And I'm somebody who knows a few things about politics. At least I've been paying attention my whole life. You know, I'm not a complete idiot, but I'm a comedian, you know, and I'm somebody who worked on Capitol Hill. I was a bike messenger, but I paid attention. When I picked up a House document, I used to read them. I used to figure out what they were talking about because I didn't want to be just a passerby. You know what I mean? I was like, these are my bills. Like, I'm getting this before it gets dropped off at the lobbyist's office. I'm going to see what's cooking here. So, but that being said, I would be intimidated if I went to Congress. So these people, they're not, the fact that they're not even scared shows you how stupid they are, you know, because they're in so over their heads. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene challenging AOC, probably the most brilliant natural politician I've ever witnessed. Like, that girl is on a different level. You want to talk about a Michael Jordan or something. Like, AOC it has a gift that you only see kind of once in a generation for communicating. You know, you talk about speaking extemporaneously on complex subjects and connecting with people, which is what politics is about. It's about breaking it down and explaining to people, this is why you should care about this. This is how this affects your life. This is why we need to vote this way on this bill. You know, she is a master of that. And she's like 30 years old. Like, she's a kid. I'm 50, you know? So, yeah. So, but my point is, like, I would be terrified if I was MGT, you know, or Lauren Boebert going into this arena where they're completely not qualified. And that's not to say everybody has to be a genius. It's supposed to be like representing the people. So it should be people back from, you know, from the states sort of doing your bidding. but you have to do the work. And I'll shut up here in a second, but like Marjorie Taylor Greene, challenged AOC to this debate. And then I guess AOC acquiesced. And then Marjorie Taylor Greene was like, okay, well then I guess I'm going to have to read all 14 pages of your bill.
Right? 2 weeks, right?
Right. 14 pages. Can you believe these crazy woke left people? Who's got time to read 14 pages? It's like, you should have read that over coffee in the morning before you even opened your mouth. But she was already tweeting and she was already challenging her to a debate before she even knew what the debate was going to be about. She didn't know what the bill was, but she wanted to say it was wrong. And that's my point. They're just paid to be trolls. You know, they're just paid to heckle the other side. That's what they are. They're hecklers. Right. You know, they're like, they want to destroy Biden's act. It's like if somebody wanted to accommodate, if another comedian was like, I want Noel to, like, I want his career to suffer. And he hired a bunch of people to go sit in a nightclub when I was telling jokes and just yell out dumb stuff all night, you know, and try to throw me off. That's the Republican Party now. That's the strategy. And if that doesn't work, let's just attack the Capitol. You know, and if that doesn't work, let's have a recount. They're recounting the votes again in Arizona. A private company is now recounting the votes in Arizona. This happened yesterday in Maricopa County. They're getting access to voters' data. A private company. The votes from the last election. The one that Trump lost. That's insanity. It's not just insanity, and it's not just a stunt. It's dangerous because it's going to undo democracy. Because what's going to happen is these counties are going to stop going with what the people say. You know, a Maricopa County, a Georgia, where they can have mass sort of like voter challenges. You know, that's the dangerous thing in this voting stuff in Georgia is they can basically like in mass say, no, we're not accepting those results. They're going to start throwing out these results in these counties. So between that and gerrymandering, you're going to have a dominant GOP again. I hate to say it, but like I'm very worried about the midterms next year, and I'm very worried about DeSantis in 2024. And you know, we got some time to talk about that, but like people need to wake up. That's not just something you watch on Maddow like last night and say, okay, they're recounting in Maricopa. It should be like, no, what are you talking about? That election is over and decided. You don't get to bring in a private company to recount the votes and then have access to all these people's information because God knows what they can do with it.
Well, and Noel, I don't know if you've watched this show. It's one of my favorite shows on HBO, The Newsroom with Jeff Daniels. And the opening sequence of that series is one of the best scenes in recent years. And one thing that he says is, you know, we used to aspire for intelligence. We didn't feel inferior to it. And we need to get back to that point. You know, you shouldn't be intimidated by people who are smarter than you. You should be happy that they're in those positions and that you're going to be protected because people who are qualified and informed about what they are doing are in charge of said program. Let's make being smart be cool again. You know, like why are we the elite? Because we read? I don't understand. It doesn't make sense what the GOP say. But as you said, they're professional trolls.
They're professional trolls, and they want their followers to remain as ignorant as possible about the issues. They don't want them. That's why Donald Trump was the perfect beast for this party, because he would just basically get up on stage and holler like he was at WrestleMania for 2 hours, you know? And like play Lee Greenwood songs and pump his fists and dance around, and people would all have a good time. And, you know, then they'd get back in their pickup truck and they'd drive home and feel like they were involved in the process. And they weren't. They didn't know what was going on. In the back door, you got all these guys redistricting their, you know, districts. You got them rewriting environmental laws. You know, they're robbing these people blind. It's essentially, to give you a proper metaphor, it's as if Trump invites these guys to a rally and then one of Trump's boys breaks into their house and steals their flat screen and their future and their healthcare. You know, like that's the scam that's going down here. And people need to get hip to it and they need to get smart. But that's not on the menu at the Republican convention.
No, it's not. And we also had this week, Josh Hawley was the single vote against the anti-Asian hate bill. Josh Hawley's a fascist. I don't think that's being extreme about it. Like, this guy is deliberately hell-bent on power. And we better pray to God that he doesn't, you know, raise to a higher level of power, because like we've talked about it before, Trump's an idiot. You know, a couple of days ago was the anniversary of him telling people to inject bleach to cure the coronavirus. It's not going to be that blatant next time. It's not.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You know, Ron DeSantis or somebody with a little more self-discipline will undo this country and you won't get it back. You know, Josh Hawley is a guy who doesn't even live in Missouri. He went to Stanford. You know, he went to Yale. He taught at St. Paul's in London, like one of the oldest boarding schools in the world. And he sat there and he was a known conservative when he was there. Like they couldn't stand him apparently. And during the first Gulf War, he sat there and like ate popcorn as we were bombing Baghdad. You know, like it was entertaining. So, and that guy's evil. They're evil. They're Nazis. You're getting neo-Nazi politicians in this country that are finding an audience. I drove home tonight. I drove up from the city. I saw a lot of, you know, rifle stickers in the back of cars and a lot of QAnon flags and stuff. And this is in Westchester. You know, this is an hour outside of New York City, which is, you know, the liberal East Coast, right? So if it's happening here, I can't imagine what it's like in Indiana and Michigan and, you know, all these other places. And people are down for fascism. People are down for anti-Asian hate. That's why he voted against it. So when he runs for president, he can be like, I didn't support any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. You didn't support what? Not attacking your fellow countrymen? Like, it's scary. It's scary. This stuff happens. The World War II was 70 years ago, roughly. You know, it can happen here. We've already seen it happen here. It should terrify people. And it's not over. People think like Trump went away and Biden's in charge now. We got a temporary reprieve. You know, the shelling stopped for a few minutes, but the war is still going on and they're building an army. They're getting stronger. And Trump multiplied because Trump is now sort of out of the picture. He's not really out of the picture, but he's not, you know, he's not on the field in battle anymore. So all these other generals and lieutenants and stuff can come forward and grab their piece of the insanity. And Trump can sort of bless them and you know, still wield his power. And that's a formidable thing that we're going to have to deal with because it's working. I wish it wasn't. I wish I'd seen less bumper stickers, you know, since January 6th. I mean, I imagine if I was a dude who had a Trump bumper sticker or a QAnon thing or a Blue Lives flag or any of this nonsense on my vehicle on January 6th, I would have been out there in the middle of the night with a razor blade taking that thing off of my freaking vehicle. I was like, yeah. I ain't driving to 7-Eleven with this thing on my car anymore, you know, like it's over. But these guys are proudly flying those flags. And that's what people should pay attention to. That's what should scare people because that means it's tied in with a nationalistic identity, you know, and that people kill over stuff like that. That's how Hitler came to power, saying you're German, you're the chosen people, you deserve more than you have. These other people are why you're not getting it. You know, put them on a train, put them in a camp, you know, do these unspeakable things for the greater good. And that's what should scare people. And we saw how quickly people were willing to do that. That's what Trump showed us. He showed us like how that can really happen quickly. And that's terrifying.
Yeah. And you know, part of the issue we talk about time and time again on this show, the 24-hour news cycle, all of the companies that benefited from those press conferences that were on every day when they knew damn well it was nonsense and it was killing people. Think how many people would still be alive today if he had taken a step back and just let the science lead it. You know, that wouldn't have happened, but it would have been a different outcome is my point. And it's a tragedy that's still carrying out to this day. And we have to continue to be proactive because 2022, you think it's a paralyzed, democracy now? If the Republicans gain control of either house, then it's going to be even more deadlocked.
That's an excellent point, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Good point. Well, we're coming up at the end of another episode, episode 8 of the Noel Castler podcast. I heard sometimes it snows in April, Jimmy.
It does in Indianapolis, brother. You know, Indiana is the only place where you get to see all four seasons in a week's time. So it's good to see that. But I did upload some songs to SoundCloud of dads. So anybody listening to this, you want to hear some of my dad's cover songs, you can check out my website, JBKOnAir.com. Com, and my SoundCloud page is there. So
that's awesome. And then you got your podcast is going strong.
Going strong, booking some different interviews. I've been interviewing a lot of guys that I went to school with because, you know, I'm trying to elevate guys that I believe in and that have a good vision for what they want to do. So my podcast is periodic, but if you go to jbkonair.com, all the episodes are there.
That's awesome. Well, I was throwing you a Prince reference too.
Oh, and Prince, of course. That's right. The anniversary of his death wasn't too long ago. And it's unfortunate that he's not here, because talk about a skilled musician.
Oh, he was the greatest. Yeah, no. And it was a horrible day. I was working on an MTV show the day he was gone. You know, we lost him and I'm still in shock. It was 5 years ago this week. And Prince was unlike anybody I'd ever seen. You know, I saw Purple Rain in the movie theater and Prince became my guy. You know, I saw it the weekend it opened and I was just blown away from that first guitar solo and Let's Go Crazy. You know, when he jumps on top of the speaker stack or whatever and just rips that solo. It was just amazing. So he was, I was in about eighth grade. He was a childhood hero. And then I got to, I got to work with him. I worked on not a bunch of stuff, but quite a few things and some big things and Super Bowl. You know, I did the Super Bowl with him. I think I've talked about that. Oh, I've talked about your quarterback guy, but, And I tweeted about this week, sort of in memoriam. And the greatest thing with Prince is that he would hire all these other amazing musicians. You know, Prince wasn't like this guy, like, it's going to be only me, when it could have been only him. He played every instrument on his first album. You know, everyone talks about how great a guitar player he was. He was just as badass on the synthesizer. He would make these synth squiggles that nobody did. He was a drummer. He was a bass player, like piano player. The guy was just a musician in every, sense of the word. And, but he got the other guys around him. You know, he would seek out talent for his touring bands like nobody else. And when I worked on the Super Bowl with him, he's the one who asked for the FAMU marching band, which is the Florida A&M marching band. It's a traditionally sort of all black school, and they just have a killer marching band. And I love marching bands. You must too. You're a football guy, you know?
Oh yeah.
There's nothing like the power of that kind of synchronized and all the, 15 snare drums completely locked in. Like, it's badass. And that, people talk about his great performance, and his performance was amazing, but he knew how powerful having that band on the field for Purple Rain was going to be. And that was my assignment. I was in charge of the band, and we had these special uniforms. Like, we took their normal marching band uniforms and put these like neon lights in them, with these battery packs. And then it was raining so hard that like a lot of the battery packs were malfunctioning and stuff, and it didn't matter. But if you watch the performance, you can see the silhouette of these guys and all this stuff. But my point is, Prince knew the power in that, and he worked on the arrangement with their MD for weeks beforehand. Like, he was involved in every note they played too. And they rehearsed like crazy. And when they came out on the field for Purple Rain, it added to that moment. So when everyone reacts to Prince's incredible performance, they're also reacting to all those others that he brought into the mix, because that energy was on the field. You know, that precision and that hard work was part of the product that he was selling. And that's, one of the things that kind of gets overlooked in Prince, because his genius was so huge. You forget about like how much he shared that spotlight, and how he mentored other artists. Like, he would give songs away. He gave the Bangles Manic Monday. He gave Sinead O'Connor, No One Compares to You. Like, the guy had a massive ear. He's a huge Joni Mitchell fan. He loved like Ani DeFranco. Like, he was into stuff you wouldn't think he was into. He was such a hip cat. He was unlike anybody else. And I have that great memory. I also have a regret when I did the NBA All-Star game in Las Vegas, probably around the same time as the Super Bowl. I was, it's a very hard gig doing the All-Star game. And that was a particularly crazy All-Star weekend. And I got invited to a Prince show the night sort of before the game. And they were like, hey, Prince is going to play with Maceo Parker tonight. Like, I can get you in. You can go to the gig. It's going to be at like such and such, at this casino and this bar or whatever. But the gig doesn't start till 3 a.m. And I was like, I got to be at work at like, I got an 8 a.m. call time. I'm going to be on the court until midnight, because we rehearsed that stuff like crazy. And I didn't go, I blew it off. I know, man. I know, I didn't go, and I would have been in this little club, and like my friend went, and he was like, oh my God, dude, it was amazing. Like Prince played for 3.5 hours, you know, with Maceo Parker. Like there was 30 people there, you know, like, but whatever, I got more than my fair share, and we all got a lifetime of music. So thanks for bringing up Prince, you know.
His archives are like, he said, he told Arsenio Hall that he would look different by the time he went through his entire catalog. There's still a lot that they could put out, the estate, you know.
I think I'd heard somebody say once, like, you've heard 10% of the music that he created, because he would make music all night long. And the thing I want to hear is he recorded with Miles Davis back in the 80s for days. Like they had a jam session that was recorded like over a period of days. And Prince said it was brilliant and wanted to put it out. And Miles's estate wouldn't give him permission to put it out when he was alive. But there's treasures like that that we've yet to hear that must be just mind blowing. Cause the guy was rolling tape all the time. I had some friends who worked for him as like guitar techs and stuff. And he was also a hoarder, which I respect, because I'm a gear nut. I keep all of my stuff, you know? And the guy was like, dude, I've been to Paisley Park, and he'll have road cases from like a tour in 1984 that are just left there in the lot. And like the casters are sunk into the concrete and stuff, you know, with just some stage monitors, you know, from, you know, 30 years old sitting there. He didn't throw anything out, which is great. When you go to make an archive about somebody, you want all those little scraps of paper and all those, you know, guitars and cables and all that kind of good stuff. So
yeah, no doubt, man, a legend. And wish he was still here. One thing that he told Arsenio too, he said, I wish I could teach. So that was one thing. He was certainly an influence on everybody, but I would have loved to have taken like a master class with Prince, you know, that subscription service, just so you could learn something from him.
But oh yeah, that would be a good one, the Prince master class.
Yeah. Get it, beloved, we are gathered here today to learn the guitar.
That sounds like an SNL sketch. We'll work that up. We'll write that up and do that, man. But God bless the purple one. I got my light purple today. I don't know if you can see it. It's kind of a blue. It's kind of a little bit blue. It doesn't show up well. But anyway, hey, guys, thanks for listening. This was episode 8 of the Noel Castler podcast. We're coming to you every Monday. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next week.